Welcome, everybody, to the CLDF-GAF-PBC podcast series. The topic this evening is building a sense of urgency for PBC patient evaluation and monitoring. I'm Dr. Kimberly Brown, professor of medicine at Wayne State University and Michigan State University. That hurts my heart when I say Michigan State University, since I'm a Wolverine fan. And I'm joined by my good friend and colleague, Dr. Steve Flam, professor of medicine at Rush University. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you so much, Kim, and welcome to everybody. And I'm a Wolverine fan, too. So I'm with you.
Yeah, I almost became a professor of medicine at MSU just to show my kids that I can do it.
But in the end, you couldn't.
Yeah. Anyway, well, you know, tonight we really want to kind of talk about, I think, how maybe you and I and the rest of the hepatology community have started to rethink how we monitor patients with PBC and kind of the intervals at which we monitor them. We talked a little bit on a previous podcast about how patients can progress in their degree of fibrosis at varying rates. And so we have guidelines out there. We have some additional guidelines that were published by CLDF regarding how we monitor these patients. So let's talk a little bit about that. So we have patients with PBC. We assess where they are in their disease process. Perhaps we place them on treatment. What are you doing in your practice? How has your practice changed in terms of when you're reassessing them? How long do you wait to reassess them, and how do you reassess them?
Those are great questions, Kim. You know, there are two main areas that I reassess, aside from seeing the patient, talking to them, and asking them about how they feel. And that's the blood tests that look at the response to medical therapy, particularly focusing on alkaline phosphatase and total bilirubin levels. And the second is monitoring the rate of progression of fibrosis. Those are the two things I do. And I would say in the last 5 years or so, I'm doing it more frequently, both of those, than I used to. I check blood tests now twice a year, every 6 months, on everybody with PBC. And if they're unstable, if the labs are high, if they're changing in an unfavorable way, I check them more frequently than that. And I focus on alkaline phosphatase and total bilirubin. When I talk to the patients, I want to make sure that they're taking their medications, that they're adhering to URSO, particularly if they're not responding as well as I hope. And I really assess patients for second-line therapy every time I see them after the first 6 months. And fibrosis, since we have had the advent of the non-invasive hepatic fibrosis tests, and they're available, they're easy to get, they're not too expensive, I actually do that now on an annual basis. Once a year, I check hepatic fibrosis. And I try to use the same test modality each year so that I can compare the tests and have a common base to compare it to. What do you do?
I would agree with you. The original guidelines, when we place patients on therapy to sort of reassess at a year to consider second line therapy, I think you and I, and I think most people that we know, don't wait that long. That most patients are going to show you whether they're responding and the degree to which they're responding at a much earlier time point than a year. And I agree with you, waiting that period of time does nothing to help the patient. It just delays, further intervention. When you look at the guidelines, I think, they're moving toward, and I think the CLDF guidelines have moved us toward, more frequent monitoring every 6 months, as you're suggesting. Are there certain patients, patient characteristics, people that you might consider at higher risk. I know in my practice, men, I don't have a lot of men in my practice, but also patients of color in particular that may have higher risk of fibrosis. What are your thoughts about, are there high risk groups, people that you might monitor a bit more closely?
Absolutely. You know, it's been long known that people of color and men both seem to have more aggressive courses and present with more advanced liver disease than others. So those are groups that should be highlighted when a practitioner evaluates them with PBC. Also, patients that have highly elevated alkaline phosphatase tend to have worse outcomes at the beginning than people who have lower alkaline phosphatases at the beginning. And then, of course, people that have more fibrosis at the beginning tend to do worse than people who have less fibrosis at the beginning. And I also think the younger people, particularly younger symptomatic people that get diagnosed with PBC, women in their 30s, they also, I think, have a course that may be more aggressive. So there are certain things when you see a patient that cross your mind that make you think whether or not they might have a worse prognosis. Kim, do you use the scores for predicting long-term outcomes?
So I'll be very honest with you. I don't routinely use them in my practice. I think that, you know, those high risk groups, as you've pointed out, those are patients that I know are at higher risk. It's doing those scores doesn't change how I monitor a patient, so, or how I treat a patient or what I tell a patient. So I have not routinely used those scores. How about you?
I don't use them either. Every once in a while, I have a patient that does. You know, some of these patients are involved in patient advocacy groups and patient groups, and they talk about the scores and all of that, and they use the scores. I don't use them in practice for similar reasons to you. I don't find them that helpful. It's more seeing a patient and knowing some of the risk factors for worse outcomes and really emphasizing to all your patients, particularly those patients, that they need to follow up, you know, as we recommend, you know, not to blow off follow-up visits and follow-up blood tests and miss liver cancer screening if they have advanced liver disease, because the danger for them is great.
Had experience maybe with a patient? I mean, are there patients now that we have, you know, choices or, you know, more options for treatment for patients than we have had previously? Has that moved you toward earlier monitoring? For example, you have a patient with, as you pointed out, a very high alkaline phosphatase. Maybe you place them on first-line therapy or ursodiol, and you know, are you going to wait 6 months? Are you going to monitor them more at an earlier time point, maybe add second-line therapy? I know that's not in the guidelines, but what do you do in your practice?
Well, when I first start ERSO, I check the patient at month 3.
Okay.
And then at month 6, and then usually every 6 months after that. I don't add second line therapy yet until month 6 because I give them a chance. But as you're alluding to, Kim, most of the response that you observe to ERSO or the second line therapy agents in PBC happens within the first 3 months, actually. There is sometimes a little bit of a drift after that, between month 3 and 6, maybe a few months after that. But the majority of the response, in my experience and the data that I've seen from studies, is right up front. So you get a pretty good idea where you're going to end up. So I follow that closely. And I tell the patients too, I had a patient today, an African-American woman in her early 40s with cirrhosis from PBC, and she's on URSO. And I started her on second-line therapy because her alkaline phosphatase has been around 215 to 220. Her original alkaline phosphatase before URSO was much higher. It came down, but it's still higher than what I want. And she feels fine, by the way. She works 50 to 60 hours a week. She doesn't have any symptoms, but surprisingly, she has cirrhosis. And I put her on second line therapy today because I talked to her about the importance of really driving that alkaline phosphatase down. So I think we have to monitor these patients, and I think we don't have to wait a long time. When patient is appropriate for second line therapy, I think we need to pull the trigger.
And do you have any, I don't really have any examples of this in my practice, but we do see it with hepatitis B and we see it with hepatitis C, where you intervene with therapeutics and patients seem to have either clinical improvement, maybe clinical stability. Have you had cases like that where treatment you feel has just, from a clinical standpoint, rather than just slowing progression of disease, has really improved the patient clinically?
I've had some patients that when started on therapy that's effective and their alkaline phosphatase comes down, they feel better. I think their energy level improves some if they have fatigue. And their pruritus improves some if they have pruritus when they have a good response. When patients have advanced cirrhosis or decompensated disease, I haven't seen patients compensate again when I start them on therapy for PBC, like you do with hepatitis B, for instance. When patients come in with decompensated disease and you ratchet down their viral loads with hepatitis B therapy, and then they get better. I mean, have you seen patients with complications of advanced liver disease that you start on therapy for PBC and they actually get better?
So I agree with you. I haven't seen that. But I think about it in terms of, you know, moving our time point for assessment closer and closer, that, you know, there's no magic to waiting 12 months. There's no magic to waiting 6 months. That really, you know, as we've talked about, if the goal is to try to delay progression of disease in a patient where we haven't found curative therapies yet, then, you know, I don't understand or see the value in just waiting for a long period of time to make those decisions. So, but I agree with you. I haven't seen what I would consider that reversal. I do think patients sometimes feel better as their disease activity kind of calms down. I do think that that is true.
Well, I agree. Again, you know, you can't be lulled into a false sense of security with PBC. You know, if patients aren't complaining of a lot of symptoms and they're really not getting better, particularly if they have fibrosis already, you need to be aggressive with second line therapy. You can't always say, oh, well, I'll see you again in 6 months and we'll talk about it then. And then they come back 8 months or 9 months later. And then you say, well, even if their outcomes are not, getting better, but they're not getting worse. And then say, you know, I'll see you in 6 more months and we'll discuss it again. Because I think in the end, you're not really doing what is best for the patient.
Yeah. So you did mention in another podcast, you know, the importance of making sure that patients don't have an additional disease. In this day and age, usually the additional disease is MASH. If you had a patient who perhaps had more than one, disease going on, PBC, MASH, perhaps, is that a patient that you might, you know, consider really moving, you know, just being more aggressive in terms of monitoring and treating?
Absolutely. Those patients, in my opinion, I don't know that there are a lot of data yet on this combination of MASLD and PBC together specifically, but it's my anecdotal opinion that they do worse. They do worse. And I think we really need to monitor them aggressively and treat them aggressively. You're exactly right. And the practitioner, I think, should be aware of that.
Yeah. No, I think that's important. And it's often challenging, right? Seems like everybody has MASLD or MASH these days. So we don't want to overlook the fact that they can have an alternate diagnosis or an additional diagnosis as well. But I just want to thank you and thank our listeners for the time that they've spent. Any final comments, Steve, that you'd like to make?
Just that when you have a PBC patient, monitor them aggressively. Do not be lulled into a false sense of security that they're doing okay and that even if they look okay, because fibrosis can move forward. And whether or not it's reversible is unclear. So you would rather it not happen. So monitor your patients, follow their alkaline phosphatase and their total bilirubin. Treat with medical therapy aggressively. Don't wait around. You know, it's month six at the latest for making an assessment of second line therapy for patients. And I think you will do your patients the best service, which is what our goal is. How about you?
Yeah, no, I think those are all really great points. I think my philosophy is that, you know, patients at the end will not die of my disease, which is liver disease, right? That we're going to keep them going, and all the other medical comorbidities that everyone has are what will eventually lead to their medical problems. But I think we have a lot more tools in the toolbox now, and I think your points are well taken about monitoring patients really closely so that we can get effective therapies to our patients. So I'd just like to thank you, Steve, for your insights tonight, and thank our listeners for participating in the CLDF GAP PBC podcast series. We look forward to the series continuing and for the audience to join in for future podcasts. Thank you.